You fellows know for the last perhaps 3 years, maybe 4 years, I've been doing quite a little bit of considering and studying regarding where we're headed as a nation and what we as believers should do about it, and what we as those who are responsible to protect our families should consider in the way of action. If it was not for the fact that my ultimate confidence is in the Lord Jesus Christ, at this point in time and history, I would panic. I think perhaps because I am privy to too much information from too many parts of the world not to realize that we're in trouble. The information that I gather agrees on several things. One, we are in for trouble. Everybody I read agrees that we are in for trouble, except our government economists. They're the only people I know that don't agree to that. Secondly, they do not know what form it's going to take. Whether it's going to be runaway inflation, followed by a crushing depression, whether it's going to be a depression. They don't know how severe it'll be, whether or not at the end of it there'll be chaos, a breakdown of the systems of our country to the place where there's anarchy and rioting and people take to the streets with guns to try and feed their families. So what form it'll take and how severe it'll be, they do not agree to. Neither do they agree to the timing, when it will happen. The earliest time I've heard is December of 1978. The latest is 1982. So it would seem that somewhere in that time frame, we're in for difficulty in our nation. Last fall, when I was in Europe, I found that the bankers in Switzerland and the bankers in Austria were much more optimistic about our future than I was, or than the moneyed people in this country are. And I began to inquire very carefully why they felt that way, and finally got down to it, and they said, well, you know, really, the United States is the linchpin in the Western world's economy. And if you go, we all go. Well, you know, if I was in their position, I'd want to be optimistic, too, about what's going to happen to us. But I think it was colored by the fact that they realized that what happens here in the United States is going of necessity to affect the entire Western world. And having said that, let me tell you why I do not panic at this point. One reason is because of Psalm 115:3. Which says, but our God is in the heavens, he hath done whatsoever he hath pleased. And Daniel 4:35, and all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he doeth according to his will among the inhabitants of the earth and the armies of heaven, and none can stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou? That indicates to me that God knows what's going on and has a control factor built in. In Job 12, verse 23, in the Living, it says, he raises up a nation and then destroys it. He makes it great and then reduces it to nothing. The indication there is that God controls the affairs of nations. The same truth is in Acts 17, 26 in the Living, where it says, he created all the people of the world from one man, Adam, and scattered the nations across the face of the earth. He determined beforehand which should rise and fall and when. He determined their boundaries, which indicates that before God ever laid the foundation of the earth, he decided which nation would rise, which one would fall, when it would take place, and what would be the extent of their geographical boundaries. Well, that indicates that God is really controlling the affairs of nations.
Amen.
And in Job 23, verse 13, it says, for he is in one mind, and who can turn him? And whatsoever his soul desireth, even that he doeth. And then over in the 14th chapter of the book of Isaiah, In the 24th verse, in the Amplified, it says, the Lord of hosts has sworn, saying, surely, as I have thought and planned, so shall it come to pass. And as I have purposed, so shall it stand. Sounds like he's in control, doesn't it?
14:24
in the Amplified. Then in 14:27 in the Phillips translation, you know, J.B. Phillips did the four prophets. In 27 it says, for the Lord of hosts has made his plan. Who can unmake it? The outstretched hand is his hand. Who can turn it back? indicating that God is, in fact, in control. And then the 12th chapter of the book of Matthew, in Matthew 12 and verse 20 and 21, the Living Bible, rather comforting thought to me at least, it says, He will end all conflict with His final victory, and His name will be the hope of all the world. And then over in the book of Ephesians, the very first chapter, and the 9th and 10th verse, as translated by J.B. Phillips, the scripture says, God has allowed us to know the secret of His plan. And it is this. He purposed in His sovereign will that all human history should be consummated in Christ. That everything that exists in heaven and earth shall find its perfection and fulfillment in Him. In other words, the last word in history will be spoken by Jesus. It'll all be consummated in Him. Well, now that's a comfort to me, fellows. That's a comfort to me. To know that God is in fact in control of the nations. He is in fact in control of history. If that were not true, prophecy would be a joke. You know, if God is not in control of history, forget prophecy. But further than that, He is also in control of the lives of His children who walk in the center of His will. If a man or a woman or a boy or a girl is walking in the center of the revealed will of God for his life, there is no other person, no organization, no catastrophe, no nation can thwart God's purpose for that one who's walking in the center of His will. Because God will marshal all the forces of heaven to see that all is applied necessary to bring to pass that which He desires. You bet.
Job what?
13 and 14, yeah. I said 13, I gave you 14, I'm sorry about that.
You had 13.
Yeah. But that's the thought, you know.
Isaiah 43:12, I believe, also says, He will work. And who will work?
Yeah.
He will work. I will work. I am the Lord. That's my name. I will work. And who will hinder it?
43:12. That Daniel passage too, Gene, you gave us what, Daniel
4:35.
Well, three or four times in that, three or four times in the same chapter, it says, till thou knowest that the Most High rule in the kingdom of man and give it to whomsoever He will. Three times it's...
Verse 32, right.
In Daniel 4. That's 25, it's in 32, and again in... Well, I guess those two verses. I try to remember.
Now, the Living 32 says, God parcels out the kingdoms of men and gives them to anyone He chooses.
Mm-hmm. That's Daniel.
4:32, the B part out of the Living. Yeah, that's... So I think we have to look at our discussion tonight against the backdrop of the sovereignty of God. But then let me give you another verse that also should be a backdrop for what we'll discuss tonight, which is Ecclesiastes 3:15. And it says, what is has been already, and what is to come has been already. And God summons back each event in its turn.
At 3:15?
Yes.
Is that in the King James?
No, I think that may be in the... Oh, it may be Living. Maybe Good News. I'm not sure. Let me look here and see if I probably didn't even write that in. I've got it written in, but I haven't put in. I don't know. I didn't put by it what the translation is.
What is has already been.
What is has been already, and whatever is to come has been already, and God summons each event back in its turn, which indicates that. That there is a repetition to history, and that God is the one who is calling it back in repetition. Of course, since human nature never changes, you expect there to be a repetition in history. Mm-hmm. Because human nature, following its normal course, will repeat itself over and over and over and over again. Not only in the lives of men, but in the lives of nations. Having said that, let's take a look at cycles of war. If you fellows have your books handy... I personally have not read any book which I felt had a better bibliography. This guy evidently did his homework. I think some of it is weak. Some of it I would not agree with. You know, the stuff on astrology and
Jesus and Aquarius and all that.
And this guy Casey and you know, some of this stuff. But I suppose if you're going to report something and try and report it in toto, you'd report every aspect of it. And I think it may be what he is trying to do. Well, let's just go through, and I'll make a comment or two as we go through. But the crucial part of it, to me, is twofold. One, what conclusions do we come to? And number two, what are we going to do about it? And I think those are the critical questions. And everything else that we say is going to be, will be background to that, because that's where we're headed. And that's what we need to look at, it seems to me. American literature and the cycles of war. Well, they take the position there that there are certain types of literature that occur in societies, which inevitably, when this kind of literature occurs, wars follow. And he makes a pretty strong point for that in Chapter 3, the cycles of monetary instability and civil war. If you look on page 13, in the second paragraph, it says that he found that in each situation, revolution was foreshadowed by the potential or actual approaching bankruptcy of the government. Now, let me ask you.
Underline a check out there.
Yeah, that's right. Now, let me ask you, do you think it's possible that our government is bankrupt?
Work.
Now, if it's true that the government is bankrupt, what are the government's options?
Repudiate debts to start over.
Well, that's one option. Repudiation of a debt. If we can say, King's X, we're not going to pay anybody. All right, that's an option.
War.
War is another option. Get a war going, you know, that'll solve a lot of problems as far as economics are concerned. What other options are available to us?
That would really make the bankruptcy worse, though, wouldn't it?
Well, ultimately, but it puts it off.
Yeah, I see.
The third one, it seems to me, is continuing inflation. Because that puts the bankruptcy off. You keep running the presses.
Mm-hmm.
Now, eventually, the market will win, but it'll take some time. But there is a fourth option. As I've thought about it just the last couple of weeks, in this vein, I think this is the most likely option of the four. Wage and price controls. If I was a politician, that's one I'd choose.
How does that pay your debts, though?
It doesn't pay your debts, Charlie. But what it does is stop the inflation machine, and it keeps you from going bankrupt immediately. And it's a gradualism of ruin. And I think if I was a politician, that's what I'd choose. Instead of an immediate cataclysmic ruin, I think I'd rather have it crumble a little at a time.
Would not a balanced budget turn the thing around?
Well, of course, this is another question, Jack. What can we do about these things? And I think we need to look at that. But perhaps at this point, we need to consider the possibility of price and wage control. Now, historically, they've never worked. Even back to the time of Rome, they tried it. But you read the history, wage and price controls have never worked. Several things happen when you impose them. One is you begin to have a shortage of certain goods. Always happens.
Everything you control.
Secondly, you develop two markets. The markets you see and the black markets you don't see. Two markets. Third, it persisted in, leads to a crushing depression. But it's gradual. So I found that in each situation, revolution was foreshadowed by the potential or actual approaching bankruptcy of government. Now, you see, if people get the idea that the government's going bankrupt, it could foster revolution. There might be a run on the banks. The banks could not cough up the money. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation has at its disposal less than 0.75% of the money necessary to cover the money it has guaranteed. Now, if that happens, and people get a little upset about it, you know, you could have a revolution on your hands. That's a possibility. All right, now paragraph 3. Just as serious a threat today is inflation. I thought this was a classic definition of inflation. Inflation is simply the result of an increase in the supply of money. And since government is creator of money and regulates the supply thereof, it is the author and finisher of the inflationary work.
Amen.
That's what it says right there. Now that's, you know, that's tremendous. Because the facts are that the machine which is generating inflation is housed in Washington. That's right. Then page 14. Down there in that last paragraph on 14, down towards the bottom of it, that's in italics, the fifth line up. I thought this was very interesting, that inflation, continuing inflation, makes men take short views. When money is good, men plant oaks. When it is bad, they can at best plant cabbages. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that. If a guy thinks that the that there is some way to retain wealth in saving, and he doesn't mind saving over a long-term period, he'll build an oak tree. But if he's afraid that's going to be wiped out by inflation the next year, brother, he's going to plant cabbages, which he can harvest the next 6 days. Mm-hmm. But you know, that has a devastating effect upon an economy, because banks, if you take your money and loan it to banks on a 90-day basis, and they're loaning money on a 15-year basis, and suddenly you call your 90-day money, they can't call their 15-year money. And, roof!
Gene, I think these two paragraphs in full are two of the most pungent paragraphs in the whole book.
But read them to us, brother.
Yeah, I mean, I really think you ought to read them.
Okay, there is no inflation which has not started with an increase in the money supply. There is no inflation which has not ended with a corruption of society, proportionate only to the degree of the inflation itself. It corrupts and weakens every social institution.
Every social
institution. That's right. It makes every member of society feel himself to be the victim of every other member of society. It sets class against class. It makes governments weak and unsure of themselves. It has in recent history destroyed more lawfully constituted governments than any other force except war itself. This is because all inflation is by nature both inordinate and unjust. In the end, it destroys wealth. But from the start, it makes a great transfer of wealth, both between classes and inside classes, which does not reflect work or merit or economic contribution, but skill and speculation, luck, militancy, or industrial bargaining power. It makes the whole economic system seem unjust, and the whole political system seem ineffective. It makes men take short views. When money is good, men plant oaks. When it's bad, they at best plant cabbages. It makes men corrupt both by impoverishing them arbitrarily and by enriching them arbitrarily. So inflation's a bad deal. Look on page 15, the third, fourth paragraph. Therefore, in italics, unless we fundamentally change things, our prospect seems for indefinite accelerating inflation, worsened by price controls, followed by a rapid breakdown of the market, of democratic institutions, and ultimately of civilization as we know it. That was by F.A. Hayek in the Wall Street Journal article, August 19, 1977. Well, you see, here's a guy who thinks that he's got the scenario figured out, the script, that's what it's going to be. And that's his summation. Well, let's press on. Down at the bottom 15, all major revolutions witnessed, one, a long period of economic growth followed by a period of sluggish growth or decline. Does that sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Two, the frustration of rising expectations of the middle class and lower class who had become used to getting a little more every year. Does that sound somewhat familiar? 10%, 12%, 15% wage rise every year, you know. Three, a ruling class divided and inept, with many feeling guilty about their position or being overly sympathetic to the social and economic underdogs, the liberals.
The Kennedys.
The passion of the liberals.
Yeah, that's right. The liberals, the bleeding hearts. Four, a significant increase in corruption, crime, and general immorality. Would you say that's true today?
Hmm.
Five, increased rebelliousness and alienation of youth from the older generation. Could you say that's true today? Six, desertion of the establishment by the intellectuals and increasingly harsh attacks and criticism. That's the the media, I'd say, and also the intelligentsia, the educational liberals, you know. Seven, abdication of the electorate, that is, increased indifference to politics on the part of the general population, making it possible for a small, tightly organized group to wield influence or take over. I don't think that's true yet today. I don't think people today are basically politically indifferent. Don't believe they are. Well, let's march on. The chapter 4, page 19. Planet cycles, climate, and war. What he says there is not from
Where are you at?
I'm on page 19.
Chapter 4.
Not from an astrology standpoint, but from an astronomy standpoint,
astronomical
standpoint. There is a time coming in 1981 when, for the first time in hundreds of years, the planets will be in line, which they have not been. Now, you know, we'd be fools to believe that gravity does not have some effect upon us, because the tides that we see in the oceans are caused by the gravitational pull of the moon. Now, what the effect will be of all the planets getting in line at one time, focused on us, I do not know. I don't think anybody else knows either. But it could be anything from a very mild reaction to a... It could even conceivably tilt the Earth off its axis and cause the both poles to become forest, rainforest, and warm, and could cause a belt of freezing right around the middle of the Earth. You know, anything could happen if you tilt the axis of the Earth, because then you tilt the degree at which the sun shines on it, and that's going to make the difference.
Isn't that happening in my reading here, where the ice or formations like that are causing a tilting?
Well, yeah, there are some who say that's taking place. Others are saying that the polar cap is melting, and that this is going to cause all kinds of problems. But anyway, I think we would have to say that when the planets line up, which they will, and what's going to happen, like, who knows. Also, they've traced sunspot activity and have found that increased sunspot activity affects the climate of our Earth. It also affects the emotional stability of people on the Earth. It also affects the ability to transmit and receive radio signals on the Earth. It really has an impact. And they've tried to trace this into what they call wet, dry, and then cold, dry, warm, dry climates. And according to the chart on climates, the drought clock, if you want to call it that, we're due to go into a cold, dry time in our nation in the next 3 or 4 years, if the clock is right. And when that happens, food production drops and energy becomes increasingly more of a problem. And so that's the point that the guy is trying to make, I think, in this particular part. On page 21, down there in the italics, general individualism with weak governments, migration, and other mob actions such as race riots, class struggles, and civil wars, ranging from palace intrigues to revolutions, occurred during the general anarchy of the Cold Dry period, which they say we're going into. People are cosmopolitan and Epicurean, borrowing culture and living by superficial and skeptical philosophy. Boy, if that's not happening in the world today, I've never seen it. You talk about governments, weak governments. Man, you know, they're changing hats almost like being in a boutique, the heads of these governments
France,
around the world.
Italy.
Oh, and look at the terrorists. Well, in page 22, the third paragraph, Mr. Dewey. You all see where I am?
Mm-hmm.
The foundations for the study of cycles and the research of Dr. Wheeler's work discovered four recurring cyclical patterns in the Index of International Battles. The synthesis of the four cycles, 142 years, 57 years, and 22.14 years, and 11.2 years, corresponded very closely to actual international warfare. The next most likely time for international war is 1982, when the combined cycles peak. So let's move on to 24. Second paragraph, sunspot activity also deserves some attention. The year 1982 is the peak of the 11-year sunspot cycle. Down to the part that's in italics, the maximum of human activities in correlation with the maximum of sunspot activity expresses itself in the following. One, the dissemination of different doctrines, political, religious, and so forth. The spreading of heresies, religious riots, pilgrimages, and so forth. Well, there you've got it, boy. The Moonies, Satan worship, you know, name it. B, the appearance of social, military, and religious leaders and reformers. I noticed that in Iran, there has emerged a group of Muslims holy men and priests.
Killed 300 and some odd in the theater today.
Oh yeah, and they are calling for back to the old religion, out with the Western ways, and we're going to go back to the Quran. You know, see the formation of political, military, and religious commercial corporations, associations, unions, leagues, sects, companies, and so forth. Wall Street Journal carried recently a front page article on the Electric Church, which took about the six or seven top radio and television preachers and gave a rundown on each one as to what their income was and what their expenses are and so forth. It was really rather revealing. Bottom of that page, I think, is critical. 24, he additionally noted that diphtheria, cholera, typhus, smallpox, and influenza reach peak proportions during maximum sunspot activity. So let's press on. To 29, chapter 5, the markets and cycles of war. Yeah.
What are your thoughts on the Electric Church?
Oh, no thought, except I think it fits in the context of C, the formation of political, military, and religious and commercial corporations, associations, unions, leagues, sects, companies, and so forth. And certainly those are religious associations that have been formed and are functioning in our country, and they've been doing quite well. You know, the 700 Club and all that stuff. Chapter 5, Market and Cycles of War. There's a great similarity between what happens to the market and what happens in war. On page 32, it talks about water, we're in trouble there. It talks about food, we're in trouble there. On 34, it talks about energy, we're in trouble there. On 36, it's interesting that down there in paragraph 1, 2, 3, third paragraph, archaeological professor at the University of Michigan, George E. Mendenhall, has discovered the following, that following the 10th generation in every civilization, chaos hits. He states, almost always a combination of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, famine, death, war, pestilence, has caused the destruction. It's our turn now. Chapter 6, Civilization and the Cycles of War. Toynbee has some interesting things to say. I suppose that most of us would agree he probably is the leading world historian of our time. Look on page 40, in italics. Toynbee regarded breakdown as the nemesis of creativity. He applies this in three areas. This is on page 40. The idolization of the ephemeral technique. Poor are ill prepared to meet the next challenge. The intoxication of successful violence, NFL football. Militarism or triumph is the suicide of civilization. Then he goes on to say that... The intoxication of successful violence, whether it's NFL football or militarism, you know, that kind of thing. The intoxication, becoming euphoric over successful violence, whether it's military victory or, you know,
hockey.
Whatever it is.
Huh? Hockey.
Hockey, you bet.
Denver, what is it? Mania? Bronco mania.
Bronco mania, you bet. And reading on there, the creative minority now changes to a ruling minority, and the masses into a proletariat, that is, a group which has no share in the civilization of its society. A schism has occurred and broken the social body into three parts, the dominant minority, the internal proletariat, and the external proletariat. The dominant minority develops a universal state, for it is in this group that the legists and administrators are found. The internal proletariat, composed of stateless exiles, exercises its remaining creativity in the development of a universal church. The external proletariat develops into barbarian war bands and fights against the empire of the ruling minority. The time of trouble is now in full swing for that society. There may be periods of rally, but the rout is destined to prevail. The Indian summer peace of the universal state is of short duration. Great men may indeed appear on the scene, and Toynbee distinguishes five kinds of saviors of society and so forth. Anyway, he takes the position, Toynbee does, that from the standpoint of civilization, that there are certain things that happen in civilization, and you can look on 43, the culture grows contemporary politically, political epochs in four cultures, and there's the springtime on page 44 is the summer and autumn, on page 45 is the winter of civilization, and you see an arrow there that says our present position. So you can draw your own conclusions from that. On page 46, down about the middle of the page where it says Rome experienced a succession of new deals. New deals take place when dynamic expansion is over, when the frontier comes to an end, when expansive sources of new wealth are exhausted, when the problem becomes one of distribution and organization rather than bold creation. And let me just say parenthetically that it now takes a third of the taxes we collect to pay the interest on our national debt. Well, yeah, either that or we're refinancing it. A great amount of it, I suppose, we're just refinancing, Charlie. As far as real wealth is concerned, I'm not sure we have any. You know, our money at one time was backed by gold, and then it was backed by silver, and now it's backed by nothing but conversation. All we have is Federal Reserve notes, and the Federal Reserve is not even a branch of our government. Did you know that? Some people won't call them dollars anymore. They call them greenies. The greenies you have in your pocket. Now let's move on. On page 48, second paragraph there, third one, what starts out, Toynbee, has already stated that a Western times of trouble, which appears to have begun sometime in the 16th century, may be expected to find its end in the 20th century. And this prospect may well make us tremble. Has government's pervasive expansion killed the drive of the creative minority? And you know there are a lot of people who can produce a lot more than they're producing now, and the reason they don't is because they're demotivated.
Well, they finally let the price of gas go up a little bit, and Texas ran out and found a lot of new gas.
Yeah.
So now, many of the new fields in Texas, they can't sell it. They're only selling 20% and letting the rest of it sit there. But the government's now changed the rules, and they're hauling in coal from Wyoming to fuel the utility plants in Texas that used to be fueled by natural gas. And the government will not let Texas gas be sold for as much out of the state as they're selling it in the state. That makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Well, let me give you an example. In Kansas, I have an interest in a gas well. There are three gas wells in this little deal. Two of them, they re-entered old holes and completed it. One of them drilled a new hole. Now, we have a contract with the utility to pay us $1.45 a 1,000 cubic feet for the gas for those three wells. The federal government will not allow this. They say the gas coming from the two wells where it was re-entry into an old hole is old gas and therefore can only be sold for 45 cents a foot, 1,000 cubic feet. But where the new hole was drilled, beside where an old one was, that you can sell that for $1.45.
So you're only selling gas out of the new hole.
That's correct.
That's what I do.
But isn't that wild? Isn't that the craziest thing you ever heard of?
They're all together, though, the holes, aren't they?
Well, yeah, you throw rocks on them almost.
And the gas from the other two will come out the one anyway.
We hope so. Conclusion on page 48. Toynbee has already stated that in Western times of troubles, has the government's pervasive expansion killed the drive of the creative minority? Is the creative minority now the dominant minority in the form of multinationals and banks? Has the majority become basically apathetic, uninvolved in governmental processes? Do individuals within the United States focus their primary activity on self-gratification? Has bureaucracy become the norm? The answers are sobering. What about Spengler's view? When will the torch pass from democracy to mobocracy to Caesarism? Is the United States in the wintertime of its culture? Is the United States a civilization? This is a time of great city development. The money of the United States is in the process of being destroyed. Now, how about Rhinecourt? Does the United States exhibit the characteristics of a civilization? Does the United States emphasize society, preservation, and duplication? Mass production? Is its industry spread over large sections of the globe, the multinationals? Are there masses of common men who bow to bureaucratic structures? Has the new United States experienced new deals? Is democratic equality the accepted standard? If so, then the time of war and Caesar is upon the United States.
Well, every question he asks, the answer is yes.
It sure seems that way. Page 49, cities. Second paragraph. The cities thrive on a complex of sophisticated, sensitive, fragile, and interdependent life support systems.
Well, that's a fact.
Given even a minor breakdown in the system, the powder keg is now subject to explosion, as was witnessed by the 1977 New York City blackout, or more recently by the Memphis, Tennessee blackout.
Mobs.
To understand, from a practical standpoint, how tenuous it is, I own an interest in a supermarket in Oklahoma City. We get a delivery of dry groceries twice a week. We get a delivery of produce once a week. We get a delivery of frozen food once a week. If there was a breakdown of that delivery system to us, in the normal course of events, our grocery store would be empty in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And if it was known that the delivery system had broken down, my guess is that the shelves would be emptied in 2 days. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, that gives you some idea of how tenuous the support system of the city is. I'd say 3 days at the outside, there'd be mob action started. Page 51. Yep. They'd come take away and know that they thought had it. Top of the page, a society depends upon stable people. People are stable when they grow in an atmosphere of love and order. These are the gifts bestowed upon us by our families. A disordered family cannot produce the stable and responsible people who are essential to the daily business of a great country. Summed up, that means when the family falls apart, the nation's not far behind. Mm-hmm. Bottom of the page. When there is a degree of breakdown in established institutions, there is a proliferation of superstition, an outbreak of astrology, soothsaying, divination. It happened in the Middle Ages, the end of Rome. Whenever there is an end of an epoch, there is a proliferation of this sort of thing. Never has been a time in our country's history that I know of when there's been as much proliferation, that sort of thing, as there is now. Next paragraph. J.D. Unwin of Oxford and Cambridge wrote in his Anthropological Study, Sex and Culture, any human society is free to choose either to display great energy or to enjoy sexual freedom. Hmm. The evidence is that it cannot do both for more than one generation. That's interesting, isn't it? Bottom of page 52. Howard J. Ruff, in September 76 issue of the Rough Times, summarized our other reasons why the cities are in trouble and ripe for civil unrest. He said, one, we have raised the expectations in the minds of our citizens. It is assumed that if something is desirable, it's automatically possible. In the last part of that paragraph, because we are not able to tolerate short-term suffering, we have given ourselves insoluble long-term problems. Two, government is the enemy of our cities. Three, city neighborhoods have moved towards one-race groupings. Four, the quality of life in the cities is diminishing as much of its citizens' resources are devoted to the simple maintenance of food and shelter. Five, we are seeing a great exodus of corporations, jobs, and middle-class population from the cities, leaving a sharply eroding tax base and increasing deficit. Incidentally, New York City is just one of many. You know, there'll be others standing in line in the next few months.
Cleveland's in bad shape.
Cleveland,
Detroit, Jersey City.
San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Six. We have accumulated a staggering amount of municipal debt, over $200 billion. History records no instance of a debt of this proportion having been paid off. It has always been repudiated. And people wonder why I didn't go into municipal bonds. I knew they could change the rules on you. Nine. Crime in the city is out of control, and some cities have become jungles. 10. The schools have ceased to teach our cities are turning out functional and economic illiterates who do not understand how the system works, and they are the voters who elect those who will have their hand on the spending throttle. The very people who are destroying the cities through their misguided legislation and policies. 11. Last of all, narcotics are sapping the strength of our cities by increasing the crime rate many times. Page 55, just below the italic rough states, I believe we will see a class war and racial stress may trigger it. I believe we will find ourselves in this position sometime between 1980 and 1985. Chapter 8, 57, Minorities, Business Cycles and Cycles of War. Let me just quote. Let's get over here to 59. Right below the italics. Reverend Jesse Jackson, National Director of Operation Push, stated, "We will have to take to the streets again." Lerone Bennett, Jr., Senior Editor of Ebony Magazine, declared, "A whole generation is growing up in the slums with no faith in American or African-American institutions." The Wall Street Journal, in an article entitled "The Black Leader's Moral Drift is a Big Problem," noted, "Blacks in the slums, young and old, feel excluded by the system and oppressed by it." Last paragraph. "The very fact that minority groups have accepted so much welfare and other aid in the past has already triggered a psychological principle that results in violence. There is a basic psychological law, listen, that an ego cannot be indebted with no means of repaying and not retaliate in some manner."
That's right.
Oh, that's tremendous.
You can't give somebody something.
Even if it's kids, whether it's your kids.
Those the implications of that are almost unimaginable. Let's move on. Page 60. The last two paragraphs. What influence has the communist movement had on the alienation of the minorities from the American system? In the latter half of the 1960s, Mrs. Charlotte Phelps was an instructor in the business school at the University of Houston. Her specialty was economics and business values. It is no wonder she was charismatic, for she was trained in Cuba as a recruiter for black communist cell blocks in Houston, Texas. As a result of her activities, Mrs. Phelps was sentenced to a 35-year term in the Texas penitentiary at Huntsville, Texas. It seems that Texans don't take too kindly to automatic weapons, grenades, and robberies on their streets. Several University of Houston students were indicted with her. Students who had been recruited by her. Mrs. Phelps' business values class was simply a communistic indoctrination program geared to the destruction of the cultural values of her younger students. Once the cultural black box was shattered, Mrs. Phelps could rebuild the communist version. At that time, she stated that the next U.S. revolution was scheduled for the late 1970s. Moving on, Chapter 9. Chondratai, for every how you pronounce it, his cycle to war theory is interesting. What it says is that he's gone back and figured it from the world, you know, way back from year one, and that according,
I didn't buy that. He missed World War II.
Yeah, that's right. According to, there's some interesting stuff in the chapter, though, in 67, on page 67, down there in that second paragraph, says, as Ludwig von Mises puts it in his economic treatise, Human Action, listen, the philosophy of protectionism is the philosophy of war. He also stated, if men and commodities are prevented from crossing border lines, why should not the armies try to pay the way for them? That's exactly the reason the Japanese jumped on that Pearl Harbor. That was it. We wouldn't let them trade. Or 69 is rather interesting.
Now they own us.
Yeah, Hawaii. The italicized part there, Fibonacci anticipated the coming of the time when the basic and intrinsic differences between male and female numbers may disappear. The two may become closer to one another. The male may become equivalent to the female. The male may acquire some of the characteristics typical of the female, vice versa. The female may acquire some of the characteristics which are typical of a male. Fibonacci, thinking and writing approximately 7 centuries ago, how do you like that, viewed this development as indicating the entering on the part of the human race into one of its darkest periods of history, a period of confusion, chaos, violence, and death.
Unisex.
Yeah, man. ERA is from the pit. 71. And we're almost to the end. We're getting close. We're doing pretty good. Interesting here in Chapter 10. As an offshoot of their research with climate, Winkles and Browning discovered that the countries with the larger standing armies, one, start fewer wars. Two, get dragged into fewer wars. Three, win a greater percentage of the wars in which they become involved. I sort of like that.
I like it too. I wish we had one.
Yeah. A legendary Will Rogers once remarked that the best barometer of an approaching war was a reduction in the military forces by the United States. Page 74, I hope that you read. Down there where it says other highlights of the report include, if you haven't read that, you ought to take the time to do it. It's very sobering.
Let's read it up.
Huh?
Let's read it.
All right. Other highlights of the report include the Army needs 15,000 tanks in order to defeat Soviet Army.
Armor.
It only has 7,000. The Army's war reserve stocks of tanks, armored troop carriers, ammunition, anti-tank missiles, and self-propelled artillery are low. Three, the Air Force only has about half of the necessary advanced air-to-air missiles needed to duel Soviet fighter planes for control of the skies. Four, few units of the Army National Guard and Reserve are rated ready for deployment. Five, the reserve manpower is drying up. Six, war planes have been grounded due to lack of spare parts. Seven, the operating effectiveness of warships has been severely cut by delayed overhauls. Eight, some of the new aircraft, ships, and other complex weapons have caused major problems due to poor reliability. If you watched the television, you saw that just a few weeks ago. They had them all out there to show them testing, shooting an underwater missile, and the thing plummeted twice. Nine, the U.S. military services are at the lowest manpower level since the Korean War. 10, the U.S. Navy, which is made up of 468 ships, is the smallest it has been since prior to the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941.
Where's all of our $70 to $100 billion a year been going to? Well, we've been paying out the money. Well, we just haven't gotten the money's worth.
Chapter 11, page 79. This is on the elitist, the philosophers, psychics, artists, composers, writers, poets, and so on, are an aware elite. And he goes on to take the position that these seers have looked ahead and said, man, we are in trouble, and that... If we don't do something about it, we've had the course. George Washington was a prophet on page 84. Page 85 at the bottom, Charles David Evans, a bishop for the Salem Ward, Palmyra State, Utah County, Utah, had a vision similar to Washington on the evening of December 25th, 1882. Then on page 86, the Aquarian age chart set for Washington, D.C. and progressing to 76. Mars is coming, so forth. I don't believe that stuff. Anyway, that's the seers. I don't do much with them. Let's go on to 12. Gan, the master forecaster. I sort of go for this
guy. I pay attention to this guy.
Yeah, the reason being that he bases everything upon facts and mathematical probability. So, you know, I'd go
for him. He made $50 million.
And that's...
He just kind of walk an x-ray chart. That's all he is.
Well, that's about right. That's about right. But I think that his...
Walking computer before they had computers.
He just took the time to work it out.
On page 92, on April 5th, 1954, Gann wrote, after 52 years of experience and research going back hundreds of years, I have proven to my entire satisfaction that history repeats and that when we know the past, we can determine the future of prices. I put time cycles to the test in my personal trading, and I have issued annual forecasts on stocks and commodities for more than 50 years, which have proven accurate. Time cycles repeat because human nature does not change. That is why wars occur at regular intervals. Gann passed from the earth in 1956. His war chart saw Vietnam. They also predict war in 1982 and 83. Who is willing to bet against him? 13. Cycles of War and Caesar. Page 93. It is time to regroup and summarize the evidence that indicates that both internal strife and international war are probability during the next 6 years. So there's no need for us to go back over that. I think we can go over to page 97. What the position he's making here, or the point, is that there are already enough executive orders in existence to be used in time of emergency to make the President of the United States an absolute dictator. He can control your money. He can control which houses get gas and how much they get and when. All these orders are already, executive orders, already are in place to be exercised in time of emergency. And the time of emergency is to be declared by the President himself. You know, he can wake up in the morning and say, this is a time of international crisis and emergency. Therefore, I invoke executive order 4569 or whatever it is, you know.
11029, right.
And we've had it.
11921.
Yeah. Well, let's
103, move. Right at the bottom of the page, you read that quote, which kind of says, today the climate is right for all that's needed is a crisis demanding immediate decision.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, on page 102, all down there in that second long paragraph where the word civilization starts there at the edge in black, it says, in Family and Civilization, Dr. Carl Z. Zimmerman stated the demise of civilization was due to the demise of the family.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting, isn't it? There's no need for us to talk about our congressman. I think that's an exercise in futility. The powerful elite, here he takes the position that the Trilateral Commission, controlled by the moneyed people of our country, who have international interest, want very badly to control the government so that they can put us into a form of one world government in order that they can protect their investments worldwide. And that's the Trilateral Commission. You know, it wouldn't surprise me at all if the Trilateral Commission put up the money for both Carter and Ford's campaign, this last campaign. I got to think about that.
Well, I think that this is the most succinct chapter in the whole book.
Yeah.
Is the deal on the Trilateral Commission. Because it's absolutely irrefutable. Now, this is this same thought was put forth by a lot of John Birch material.
Time magazine, though,
and there have been economists who have exposed. It used to be exposed as a Zionist movement, and then that didn't quite fit. And then it was a communist. Now it's called the Trilateral, but it is definitely
for real
an elite, which is controlling. It controls the federal reserve. It controls. But more than that, it says it doesn't say that it controls the government. It says it is the government. It's the government behind the government, right?
Well, that's true.
Is that basically West Germany, Japan, and the United States?
No.
It's
multinational corporations, mainly.
Shell, probably like that.
Coca-Cola, Singer.
But Time magazine was listed in there, and Time has not been very kind to Jimmy Carter lately.
Yeah, but you see, they throw all kinds of smoke screens. That doesn't mean anything. They're
just reporting the news.
Right. One of the... Go to page 134, Genius.
Wait. Before we do, let's stay with 113 just a minute. I think one of the most telling comments in this whole chapter is right there in the last paragraph on page 113, where it says, perhaps... That explains UPI correspondent Helen Thomas's quote of Mr. Carter. Mr. Carter stated, I have chosen a cabinet, most of whom I did not know ahead of time, who are superb. Okay, you think a man would choose a cabinet, people he doesn't know. There is not a single cabinet member whom I consider to be weak or whom I would replace if I had free option to do so. Why can't he? Mr. Carter is stating that he did not choose his cabinet. More importantly, he did not know anything about them. Also, he can't fire them. You know, who is running?
Well, that scares your pants off.
Well, it really does. It's very interesting. Well, let's press on.
It's odd that he would say that.
Hmm?
It's odd that he would say that.
Well, yeah, it really is, you know. We'll press on past that to page 127, Carter's conflict. I don't think we need to carry through much on that. You know, Wayne and I had the privilege of meeting the president and his lady at the White House recently.
How did that come about?
Oh, it was a deal through Jimmy Allen, the president of the Southern Baptist Convention. Didn't do too well in raising money either, Wayne. Did you ever get a report?
No.
$998,000. But there were 103 couples there.
How much was it?
$998,000.
Average 10,000 piece?
Yeah, it wouldn't be quite that much.
What was the money to be raised?
All they were touting this mission service corps deal that the Southern Baptists are pushing.
Gene told me probably wasn't going to be money.
That's right. That's not the problem.
Gene, there's one bit that you've skipped that I think is really important.
Okay, let's go back and get it. All right.
What page?
116, the middle of the page. It says, well, actually the whole page is Carpell points out the dollar devaluation is in the best interest of the multinationals. In the middle of the page, it says, well, actually the whole page is Carpell points out the dollar devaluation is in the best interest of the multinationals. That's the elitist whose interest is overseas, not just centered here. Says first they raise the prices of the products they can sell in the United States, so they can pass through to the consumer the increased cost of imported raw material. But labor contracts make it possible for them to delay raising wages proportionally. The wages that they're paying out never rise as fast as the prices they're taking in. Now, simultaneously, when the value of other currency goes up, compared to that of the dollar, the multinational balance sheet looks better because the foreign currency they're earning overseas is suddenly worth more dollars. It never has there been a time when there was more industry outside of the United States owned by these top-level multinational corporations or elitists inside the United States. So the devaluation of the dollar over here makes their holdings overseas all that much better. Now, some $50 billion is owed to U.S. banks by third world countries. They cannot pay. Zaire recently defaulted. The banks cannot repossess a country. If a domino effect ensues with other less developed countries defaulting on their loans, the banking system collapses. Carpell states the trilateral solution. The only solution, now get this, this is what's happening right now. The only solution is to lend the deadbeat LDCs, that's the lower developed countries, that's Zaire, on and on. Lower deadbeat LDC. Still more money to pay off the loans that are about to go sour. Problem. The banks don't have enough good money to throw out the bad because they have already lent all the good money to LDC that now can't pay. Solution. Steal the money from the U.S. taxpayer. The banks in trouble are the giants. Chase, Manhattan, Citibank, Bank of America, Morgan Trust, and First National of Chicago. A crisis in one of these monsters could trigger a run on the banks. And I believe that's about it, that we're just on the brink of that right there.
Well, let me ask you your opinion on this. A fellow told me recently that Prudential sent one of its vice presidents to a seminar in Denver, I think. And this vice president was telling him that at the meeting, the speaker kept talking about the red dollar. And finally, he punched him and he said, "What's this red dollar?" And he said, "I'll tell you the break." And he got out to the break and he said, "That's the reevaluated dollar." And he says, "The fact of the matter is that the United States has right now stacked in cities across America for distribution, the reevaluated dollar that's being called in the private sources the red dollar. And it is ready and can be distributed overnight." Not overnight, but shortly.
What's the point? All they've been doing is printing more money anyway.
Well, the point is they make you give in 20 of your green dollars for one red one.
Reevaluation of our currency. Now, this is how close and how imminent it could be.
But you know the thing that worries me more than anything is to read this list of the trilateral commission.
Oh,
yes, sir.
And all you got to do is read the last man on it.
Who is that?
Andrew Young.
Uh-huh.
All you got to do is read.
That surprised me.
Back up through here, William Scranton, David Rockefeller, because he's the...
And you know the witches claim that he is the head honcho?
Robert Ingersoll, ambassador to Japan. I mean, there's more liberal skunks in this basket than I've ever seen.
That's where they came from. That's home nest. Well, having said all that, let's go on to the conclusion because we need to...
Don't you want to touch on Mr. Carter's...
Yeah. Political reality and what the Trilateral Commission wants to do. I think he's got a real conflict. He looks to me like a man in tremendous conflict. I think he wants to do what is right, but they've got the controls on him. And political reality will not allow him to play Sunday school hymns. So it's a tough situation.
It won't allow him to apply his born-again principles.
Christian principle, that is correct. I have a feeling that he's a lightweight man in a heavyweight job.
Does he know it?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. Well, let's look at the conclusion. Page 143.
What are you doing? You skipped a chapter.
Mm-hmm.
You want to skip Hegel?
Yeah. He is dialectic. Unless you've studied Karl Marx, you don't need it.
Well, there's one, but there is one point that Hegel makes that, that is...
Point that out to us.
...very relevant, which I think is...
What page?
Where's my paper? This is where I made my notes. I've got to read you my notes on it. It's not my summary.
Look in your Bible there.
Did you lose your notes?
Lost my notes. Page 134. First of all, the omnipresence of the Hegelian dialectic makes war a dead certainty. Now, what is his dialectic, or what is it? The dialectic is...
Where are you on 134?
Pardon?
Where are you?
In the middle of the page.
The dialectic, is... One thing is true, there's an opposite which is false. That's
thesis,
the dialectic.
Right. And his thesis versus antithesis is that the versus is conflict. In other words, there's a thesis versus antithesis. In order to achieve the synthesis, the versus is the conflict. Thus, using Hegel's dialectic, this up the top is conflict is the only road to progress and truth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what this is saying, what this basically is saying is, to the best of my observation, is that situational, that the philosophy of situational ethics eventually leads to war. It's got to. In other words, there is no right or wrong. The only right is in the conflict. The only solution is in conflict. And of course, that's the communist. That's the basis that the communists operate on. But
that's true.
What gets me is that David Rockefeller, Daddy and Granddaddy, were so ingrained with this. If you look at this is one of the few testimonies in the whole deal. Page 135, down the half, most of the way down the page, he said,
"Survival of the fittest."
And then Andrew Carnegie, stated, "Light came in as a flood," writing about his conversion to Spencer and Darwin. This is not Andrew. Wait a minute. This is
back up Rockefeller.
Rockefeller. It's
justified industrial monopoly.
Right. Rockefeller justified his industrial monopoly under the doctrine of the survival of the fittest. In fact, he taught it in his Sunday school class. That's, you know, where he taught that. And you know what resulted was Riverside Church.
Mm.
And the whole process of the undermining and the liberalization of a great segment of American theology came from this and was financed by Rockefeller. And then you have Carnegie and both of them. Light came in as a flood, and all was not and all was clear. Not only had I gotten rid of theology and the supernatural, but I'd found the truth. Now, what is their truth? Their truth is this cotton picking
the whole next paragraph explains what they believe, beginning at first line on 35 and top 36.
The Hegelian dialectic is the philosophical, logical methodology underlying Russian and Chinese communism and American big business. That was my point, was that American big business is operating on the same thing. They know that eventually and ultimately ruin will come, but it's a real heyday while we're going. And they're willing to sacrifice the end result for the conflict of now. Because you got to show a profit, you got to show success, you got to show
growth.
Growth is necessary. You cannot stand still.
If you do, you fall apart.
It is commonly held that consumer is king. Business competes for his money. However, with the ruthless Hegelian dialectic underlying big business in the United States today, the logical end result of a few monsters at the top lays to waste the concept of consumer sovereignty and service. The big producers, this is the end of the bottom of the page, 136, decide what, when, how much to produce, including the volume of construction, producer goods, activity as new plants. I was thinking about this when we came by the GM plant today. Office buildings. In other words, volume and rate of reinvestment of profits and savings determine swings in consumer demand. The producer decisions, as everyone knows, are governed mainly by changes in expectations of profit.
I don't agree with that because I don't think it's true. I was in a Woolco store last week in Texas, and we surveyed four stores. Skaggs Albertson called the boys and said, I want to give you six stores in Dallas and one in Waco and one in Beaumont. Go put in two lines in these stores. And Waco was not open, so they asked Kirk to survey the four competitive stores down there to see what to sell the stuff for. And we surveyed Kmart, Woolco, Gibson's, and a drugstore or two. And Woolco, man, I went broke in the retail business, and my store never did look that bad. Over half the display space was vacant, you know. On hair rollers, they had four only brush roller packages in the whole store. And it was just terrible. It's not because of investment. They've got 1,900 stores, you know. Wall Street says they're doing fine. They've got, it says right here, in other words, volume and rate of investment of profits and savings determine swings in consumer demand. Well, the consumer's not shopping that store. They're going over to Kmart because Kmart's got a complete selection and it's clean and wide aisles, you know. And I think that competition still works here if it has a chance to play in the marketplace.
If it was a free market system, but it's not.
Well, it is when the woman spends her money in one of four discount stores.
True, when there's money and so on and so forth. But I still think that it's true with his summation down at the bottom of the page. Producer greed, geometric growth, and producer sovereignty go hand in hand and are moving presently like an ever-increasing accelerating automobile running off the road. Of course, a war could be suggested as a solution to the problem on an intermediate-term basis. And in the view of some, war did solve the problem in World War II.
It's just like airplanes. They lost money for several years. Everyone lost money. All the big airplanes lost money. Okay, the government took their hands off of them just a little bit and let them decrease their fares. Now they're all full. And they're making money. They're making 8 and 10 times as much money as they made even 2 years ago because they're running with 3/4, 80%, 85%, sometimes 100% full. And competition would solve a heck of a lot of problems if we could just get it back in the marketplace.
Oh, I agree.
If government would keep messing around.
If government would stay out of it.
And it's like we're expanding our church in Oklahoma City. And if we had twice as big a church, we'd have twice as much people. But a mile north of us is a village church setting up there. And if that was true, they'd have a lot of people. They don't have. You've got to have a product that people want. They're not going to buy, whether it's preaching or hair rollers. And if competition would solve a lot of problems here if they just turn us loose.
Same for the energy base.
Yeah. Pardon me. Go ahead.
Well, I think that's a point well made. Let's get to the conclusion.
Okay.
Page 143. Panics are the result of surprise. That's right. Will the acceleration of the forces cycles bring radical changes and engulf the masses? Just as the masses in the market expect much higher prices at the top, so could the masses be absolutely shocked if their lingering expectations of good times in the future are shattered. If I might interject a thought, I believe we are in for a shattering time of one kind or another. But I believe the masses of people are going to be just like that bunch of hogs into whom Jesus cast the demons. They're going to be rushing blindly down the cliff, not realizing that destruction is at the end. And I hope that when that day comes, some of us will be standing high up on the ridge
watching
them go instead of being a part of them. Would a mass surprise result in violence, internal as well as international? Can the public be warned of the potential danger? You know, probably not. They say, oh, it can't happen here. Won't happen to me. Everything's going to remain just like it has been, except more so. For the reasons discussed in the introduction, the masses are not inclined to listen. Historically, people resist change at all costs. Unlike members of the animal kingdom who instinctively flee danger, man sits around clinging to illusions of security. Institutions can only change slowly. Will that be satisfactory in the near future? History says no. To think otherwise is to ignore the unending cycles of civilizations and wars. The flow of the tide eventually sweeps everything in its path. The evidence gives an ominous warning. It may well be that during the next 6 years, true wealth will be measured by having plenty of food to eat, water to drink, good health, and safe and warm living quarters in the midst of friends and family. The cycles say the judge with the sword is on the way. The worldwide presence of the Hegelian dialectic multiplies the scope and intensity of conflict. One can best prepare for a difficult period by doing whatever one can to become self-sufficient. Creative brainstorming with like-minded friends and family is recommended.
Why this is where you decided that we ought to talk about it here.
Right, brother. It's recommended. In hard times, no man is an island. Group efforts and supports are a must. Start with the basics. Self-sufficiency in the production of food, water, shelter, clothing, and energy are the categories deserving attention. A garden, greenhouse, hydroponic system, plus the raising of small animals such as rabbits, milk, goats, and chickens are excellent in the food production area. Property on a creek or near a body of water, a spring, a windmill, a cistern, all fulfill the water self-sufficiency requirements. A well-insulated dwelling with a wind or solar energy source makes sense, as does a wood heat and cook stove. Underground protection is a must. An oversupply of clothing for all seasons is recommended. Provision for self-defense goes without saying. Excess capital should be applied towards barter items and real money, gold and silver coins. As is said in real estate, the three most important considerations are location, location, and location. At a certain point of time in the near future, living in the cities could be the equivalent of holding a stick of lighted dynamite. The best locations would then be in rural communities that meet the following criteria. I don't think we need to run through there. The last chapter on 145, I mean the last paragraph. There's no such thing as neutralizing all risk, and I think that's important to know. I've studied this for several years now, and I've decided there's no way to be absolutely safe. There's no place on earth where all the above criteria are perfectly met. Life itself is a risk. Perfect security does not exist. Lack of perfection, however, does not justify a let's eat, drink, and be merry attitude. Risk must be managed. That is the prudent man's approach. This work is attempted to show that during the next 6 years, the risk of war is very high. In the light of this, priority should be given to preparation for coming difficult times. Nick Gramlich finished reading that book just a couple, 3 days ago, I guess Friday of last week. After he finished, he came rushing in and he said, in reading his conclusion, he said, you could have written that 3 years ago.
That's the gospel truth.
And I said, yeah, that's right, Nick, because I understood what he said in the conclusion 3 years ago. So, the question is, after having looked at that, what is your conclusion? What do you think is going to happen? I'd like some input. How does it look to you? What's your guess?
I think we're going broke financially. It's just a question of when. This red dollar I hadn't heard about, but that might well be the next step.
I think that they're going to choose the inflation route, the politicians. And I am not sure whether they can keep it. I think that the outside countries are going to force us into a hyperinflation and a reevaluation of the currency. And I think all of that will come prior to any kind of a war or a revolution or anything like that, because I think the politicians are that desperate to keep things going.
In case of devaluation of currency, how would that work with contracts like leases, Gene?
Well, theoretically, they devalue them too. If a guy owed you $200 a month rent, and he would then owe you $20 in red dollars.
But if you owed $10,000 on your home, you'd owe
$1,000 or $500, whatever, you know, 20 to 1.
The guy that gets beat is the fellow who's holding the bag then with the most money, isn't he?
Well, not necessarily, because theoretically, it would hit everybody the same.
Well, here's the only trouble. I've tried to think through this on the three small investments that I have that I owe money on, you know. And I was talking to my partner, Bill Fisher, about it. And Bill and I agreed that hyperinflation is as destructive as a depression. Because if we have hyperinflation, my tenants are going to go broke. They're going to have to close their businesses. And so I think the only reasonable solution that I can grasp is to choose those tenants that I think can make it through a crisis and try to anticipate the reevaluation of the currency or the hyperinflation and go in there and pay off those loans with the cheap dollars. And let the others go.
If you knew the timing.
If I knew the timing.
I just finished a book called You Can Survive in a Spastic Economy. Very interesting book. And he said you ought to sit down and figure what your real worth is and decide which assets you're willing to give up in order to protect others. Yeah. I'm working on that right now. Just take a look at it, see what it looks like.
Pay off those loans.
That's right, and be willing to give up the other assets that are in corporations if you have to. Decide which ones you will be willing to unload, which ones you'll keep. Also, I'm about halfway through a book on You Can Profit from the Coming Price and Wage Control. That's a rather interesting book, too, that I've been working on. And I've got two more ahead of me, one by an ex-Secretary of the Treasury. I want to read Simon. I think we need to make some decision in our own minds as to where we think we're headed. If we're headed for hyperinflation, the result of that will be eventually either price control or a crushing depression, one or the other, or repudiation of indebtedness. Because don't you believe that if things get bad enough where prices are going up every day and people demand to be paid every day because they want to buy it today because it's going to be higher tomorrow.
Like the German mark.
Exactly. There'll be a demand from industry and business and a demand from the unions and a demand from the public that the government put on wage and price controls and stop this.
Yeah, they will.
That's right.
All right, then they'll put on wage and price controls.
Of course, I have a problem with all this, and I don't want to change the whole rest. But my problem is this: number one, human nature has never changed.
Right.
That's right.
And if human nature has never changed, then we know that every civilization eventually is headed for chaos. Humanism always eats up grace, right? Everything that man touches eventually comes tumbling down. Because of man's self-centeredness and man's greed, and because man is at the center of his universe, right? So this civilization is not going to escape, even though we are a very sophisticated civilization. And America is not going to escape just because she happens to be
the most sophisticated nation that's
ever been, right?
England lasted 1,000 years. Though.
In other words, that's right. England lasted 1,000 years, but at a particular time, when communication and travel was not at the sophisticated level it is now.
That's true.
All of the scientists, in other words, 90% of the scientists that have ever lived are alive today.
That's right.
What took you a lifetime to work out with a pencil and paper 50 years ago can be worked out in 50 minutes today with a computer. And so you have this unbelievable multiplication. And we also know that God is the judge. And God is going to judge man's corruption unless there is repentance and unless an intercessor stands in the gap. Okay?
Okay. Okay.
So God's going to judge America, and it's going to come tumbling down. Just like Rome came tumbling down when Paul was alive, and the apostles. Now, obviously, the apostles and Paul knew that Rome, and that there was a certain movement of things, and that it was tumbling down. What did they do? And my question
is,
what can I, the average individual garden variety Christian, do today? In other words, I'm locked in. I'm preaching the gospel in a place, it's like Ironside said about the study of the deeper life. What do you think about it, Dr. Ironside? Well, he said it's okay if you have the time and the money. In other words, I'm not Gene Ward sitting over here on several million, and I don't have the time and money to worry about how to save the several million. And I don't have the time or the inclination to buy a ranch or the time or the inclination to go out here and dig my holes and arm myself and do all this. I got to stand down there in the pulpit and preach and see people get saved come hell or high water because I don't have any options.
I agree with you.
I can't go to the country.
I agree. Yeah, that's for you.
On the other hand, Paul didn't go to the country either.
Most of us can't go to the country. Can we? So what I'm saying, so what can we do?
Do what we can.
We can know that it's going to come, and we might say that it's going to come, but what can we do?
Well, there are some steps that anyone can take.
Well, I can buy me a pistol.
Let me give you the.
You can get some food in. I never have done anything like that.
Let me give you the other. Let me give you a little bit of the other
side.
Of
you
it.
Get
no, that's just temporary.
Well,
all right. Let me.
Well, hungry temporary might help.
You could at least, friend, if you do this, you could put some of your savings in gold instead of in the savings loan.
How can I put savings in gold?
Well, if you're putting any in the savings loan, you could put it in gold instead.
How?
Buy gold coins.
Buy gold coins. There's stock in some guy in Philadelphia has got it fixed up where
gold
you can
stock.
Buy shares in gold that is stored.
But if there's a collapse,
I'll never see that gold. I'll never be able to get to it.
Gold has always been good, Charlie.
Yeah, but if I have a share in it, I'm not going to be able to go to Philadelphia and get it.
No, that's right. That's where you need gold coin.
Yeah. Well, what I need then is a pound of bacon and a sack of flour.
I had concluded this. Now, Gene and I were talking coming in here, you know. Last time we were here together, I didn't have anything to worry about because I didn't have anything to lose.
Kind of like a nigger in a crap game of 60 cents. You can go shoot it all.
And now, you know, just in that one year,
I'm still
I'm not rich, but I have something. And so I'm concerned about protecting it. And I'm thinking this. Now, the three small investments I have bring me about $1,400 a month cash flow above debt service.
That's real good.
All right, now, I've thought of a plan, I'd like to run it by you, that if we're going to have hyperinflation, we're going to have this other,
increasing inflation rates,
normal inflation is what we're in now.
We'll say.
10% a year.
Say 0 to 10%. Double-digit inflation would be 10% to 99%.
Like Brazil had 30% two years ago.
Then hyperinflation would be like we had in the American Revolution when you heard, you know, not worth a continental. Or like after World War One, the German mark, it would take 13 million marks to buy a loaf of bread. And tomorrow it would take 26 million, you know. Well, now, I thought that a good plan, in other words, like I'm answering Don's question, what can I do? There's something that we can all do. Now, I figured, and I told my wife, I said, now, we can do this. Take, say, half of that cash flow from those investments and put it in gold. And if I can anticipate that reevaluation coming, take my cheap dollars, take that gold and buy all those cheap dollars I can and go down and pay off that one of my loans. In other words, I got three deals, and if we had a crisis, frankly, I'd probably lose my two fast food deals. But I think my cook, paint, and varnish company building would survive. So I go down, if I can anticipate that, take those cheap dollars in and pay that loan off and put the other two in a corporation.
There's something... more basic than that, Charlie.
Okay.
Well, listen.
Yeah, I've tried to make up in my own mind, at least, a list of priorities in preparation. And the number one, in my opinion, is water. Because you're not going to survive long without water. But that's number one. Nearly anybody can provide an emergency supply of water. If nothing else, buy you a water bed and fill it. That'll hold a lot of water. Number two is food. Number three is clothing and shelter. And number four is protection. Until you get those four taken care of, I wouldn't begin to worry about the buildings.
And what you're talking about is for that period of time that he was describing, that 2 weeks, or you were describing that 2 weeks, before the
martial law,
the martial law or whatever could come in and take care of that grocery business.
Of course, I think that the period of unrest could run as long as a year.
But likely, with communication, as Don was pointing out.
But the point is,
we have a dictator.
I understand all that, but I'm living in the midst of a city. There's nothing that can change that.
Okay, but suppose that that you could take these four items right here and anticipate a 3 day to a 3 month crisis where the mob is taking over and stripping the grocery stores and shutting off the energy down at the city hall, the city utility plant. See, that's what's going
on.
Well,
I'll tell you, it's frightening. I was in Chicago and had an ice deal where the blizzard, the ice fell on the trees and trees fell on telephone lines and electric lines and they had no electricity. And they were calling in wiremen as far away as Denver to go to Chicago. And it just about shut everything down. Well, I was staying in a hotel, and they had natural gas for heat, which is fine, except they had an electric fan, so we had no heat. And they had a well, they had no water. Electric pump, so they had no water. And people who smoked cigarettes couldn't buy cigarettes because they didn't have the electric cigarette machines wouldn't work. And if you rent a car, you can't buy gasoline because gasoline pumps are electric. They don't work either. And you know, it's just surprising how much we depend on that crap when you don't have it.
I understand all that. But what I'm saying is, unless you were making plans to flee that,
no,
you got somewhere to go.
You and I can store some water and some food because I don't have a water problem. I got a leg down.
Yeah, but not for very long.
No, but I tell you, a couple of weeks would help out.
What's the difference between Jerry and Cynthia and Candy and James Donald and the rest of you having water in that house that you barred up or nailed up and you got your guns, you know, trying to stay out of that mob action that's out there in the streets. And you can stay there and have plenty to drink and plenty to eat for that 6 weeks until Caesar takes over, the dictator takes over, and martial law and the military and the National Guard are called up and everything is quelled down. I don't think it'll last forever. I think Gene has said, six?
Who knows?
A year. But I think that with our communications the way it is now, I think it'd be 6 weeks.
Well, let me give you the other side of the coin for just a minute. In the first place, I do not believe that God is finished with the United States of America. I don't believe that. And the reason I don't believe it is for three reasons. One of them is that 86% of all of the missionary endeavor in the world is supported from the United States of America. Now, if God's heart is still to seek and to save the lost, I do not believe that He's going to destroy 86% of that base. Secondly, the promise made to Abraham in the book of Genesis, when God said, I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you, that promise has never been rescinded. And there's been no nation in the history of the world who has treated the Jews as well as we have. Never. You read history. There are more Jews in New York City by head count than there are in the entire country of Israel. Third. Remember also in the book of Genesis when God appeared to Abraham and told him he was going to go down and do Sodom and Gomorrah in? And David began to trade with him. He said, well, Lord, if we find 50 godly men, would you destroy the city if 50 godly men were there? And God said, no, I wouldn't. And said, well, how about 40? Well, no, I'd spare it for 40. And I don't get mad, God, but would you go for 30? You know, and finally got down to 10. The Bible says, no, I'd spare it for 10. And then the Bible says that God left him. He got tired of that Jew trading with him, you know. But I believe that there are more than 10 spirit-filled, God-fearing, holy men in this nation walking with God. And I just do not believe that the axe or hammer of God is going to fall on us at this time. So let me say that. Mm-hmm. Then let me read a little article to you out of Chain Store Age. This is August issue 1978.
My old magazine.
Yeah, I read that, Jack. I read Chain Store Age and Restaurant News and Building Products. I want to see what's going on, you know. This is written by John B. Lightfoot, Jr., the editor of the magazine. It says, opinion headlines can do us in. Depending on which paper or magazine you read and during which day of the week you read it, headlines give you the idea that, one, the U.S. economy's growth rate is faltering badly, two, a recession is imminent, three, the federal government is doing little but jawboning to put a brake on rising inflation, four, the U.S. citizenry is revolting, five, consumer confidence is sliding, and six, free enterprise as a viable economic system no longer works. He said, while there's obviously a shade of truth in each of these statements, the American press is doing a pretty good job in promoting a pessimistic environment that, if unchallenged, could indeed force us all into a recession. J.C. Penney Chairman Don Seibert, in answer to a reporter's query, recently commented about the press as follows. Extremes seem to be noteworthy, he said. And the negative extreme is more likely to get news coverage in the press and on TV. The writing of negative headlines must be hard to resist. Seibert went on. Unfortunately, business people who testify before congressional committees sometimes foster that negative feeling. They tend to overdramatize the dangers of pending legislation, telling our legislators that a proposed law or changes in existing laws will have devastating effects upon the business community and might jeopardize the future of entire industries. In his closing remarks, the Penney chairman stated he was concerned with the notion of self-fulfilling prophecy. If people believe that the economy is about to slow sharply, they will cause this to happen by their actions. The Penney chairman is a man who always chooses his words very carefully. In my view, his remarks are right on the money. I couldn't have said it better. The general merchandise industry has no reason to run scared. Both sales gains and profit returns for major chains at mid-year are running ahead 14 and 11% respectively. Stores all across the country are bubbling right now. Parking lots are full outside Woolco's, Kmart's, the Treasury in Chicago, and major shopping centers around Dallas. Traffic is running heavier than it has at any midsummer season in years. Long Island, New York highways on Saturdays are jammed with cars headed on shopping forays to Macy's, Gimbel's, and Lord & Taylor's as much as toward the beach. With this kind of momentum and gear, chain retailers face the challenge to keep it moving. Just because the headlines say business will or could be bad, or consumers are buying now strictly as a hedge against later price increases, doesn't mean that automatically it will happen. Shoppers will respond to a positive business attitude they always have. Consumers are not helpless in the face of bad news reporting, but they need support. It is up to all chain men to give them that and to see that they do not become victims of emotional headline-directed economies. Mm-hmm. There's another side of it. I now quote from a letter from Walt Henderson. Dear Gene, the purpose of this letter is to thank you. This is dated August 14th. Thank you for the book Cycles of War by R.E. McMasters and to respond to it. I deeply appreciate your sending it my way. I read it with keen interest and would like to interact with you as follows. It is obvious not only from the main body of the book, but also from the appendix, that McMasters embraces a biblical view of absolute truth based on the God of the Scriptures. One would gather that he is a born-again evangelical Christian that would feel at home in our fellowship. He also believes that unfolding of human events are entirely predictable. The cataclysmic events that are about to occur somewhere within the vicinity of 1982, give or take a dozen years, is not only predictable from events that are presently unfolding, but also were determinable through mathematics, economics, astronomy, astrology, religion, history, and so forth. Although history is linear in that it has a beginning and an end, it is cyclical in the sense that history repeats itself. Because history repeats itself with a great degree of predictability, it is easy to see what is unfolding before our very eyes. In essence, what he is saying is that though God is in control of human history and is the author of man's destiny, his leadership is predictable. And this, McMasters, may be very accurate. But having said that, it also has to be noted that this type of thinking runs counter to traditional Christian thought. The latter says that God's moving in history is not predictable in a general sense, other than the nations can know that God will ultimately reward righteousness and punish evil, i.e. the law of the harvest. I don't agree with that comment, but that's all right. The particulars of God's plan can only be seen through special revelation, i.e. the prophets, including the Gospels and the book of Revelation. This is not to say that McMasters is suggesting that the kind of cataclysmic event that we are about to experience will usher in the second advent of our Lord. He makes no such claim. The point I am making here is simply that God's unfolding of history is clearly predictable for the individual who wishes to have his eye to have eyes that see. Is precisely at this point that I am torn. My theology says that God is not that predictable, but the evidence that he lays forth in his book is nigh on to being irrefutable. That coupled with my own intuitive feel for what is unfolding before us will lead me to believe that a cataclysmic event of the magnitude that he is predicting is just around the corner. It sounds like what you're doing, preparing your ranch, is, from his counsel, the best preparations you made. Gene, I'm not really sure what kind of application I personally should make in my own life regarding it, and would appreciate any input that you might have for me in this regard. In the meanwhile, though, my deep appreciation of you keeping me in mind when you run across books like this. My love in Christ, Walt.
I wish I could write like he talks. Or talk like he writes.
So, gentlemen, there you have the situation as it exists. I think each of us have a responsibility to interpret it in the light of what we believe our responsibility is before God to our families, and to do that which God would lead us to.
You've had some experience now over the last couple of 3 years on the storing of food, and I want to pick your brain a little bit later, maybe out of this group on that.
Fine.
And the other thing I need to pick your brain on is protection. I haven't had a gun since World War II, or Korean War, whenever it was I saw my last pistol.
Well, I can give you my summation on those two very quickly. As far as food storage is concerned, there's an outfit called Mountain House Freeze-Dried Food, which is the best outfit that there is. I talked to their general manager today. I asked about getting a distributorship in Oklahoma City. And he has a distributor servicing Oklahoma City out of Utah. I'll be talking to them. I think
that's a long way for a distributor.
I know, but I think that I can probably buy the stuff at about 30 off. Distributor gets 40 off, but if we buy it at 30 off, we're doing pretty good.
It's freeze-dried?
It's freeze-dried food. Has a shelf life, they know, of at least 10 years, and NASA says 20. So, you know, the food is good. As a matter of fact, we're eating some of it in our house every week now. I want to know what it is, if it's palatable, and if we can, you know, if we can handle it. Delicious. You had some of the peas the other night. Yeah, really, so far, what we've eaten, Charlie, is delicious. It is not cheap. So I'd say freeze-dried food is one of the answers. I'd say storage of number one hard red winter wheat is another one. Storage of sugar, storage of rice, beans, salt, because these are all good, you know, those are mostly good protein sources that are not very expensive, really. But you take those sources, your wheat, your rice, your beans, and supplement it with some of the freeze-dried foods, and you're in pretty good shape, really. Also,
what kind of storage space does this, most of it have to have? Or just ordinary?
Yes, you can put it in your closet.
I see.
I've got enough freeze-dried food for 6 people for a year in a space not more than 4x4. maybe 5 by 5.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So it's not, you know, the space is not a problem.
Freeze-dried, does that mean you got to keep it frozen?
No.
It's not like frozen, freeze-dried coffee.
Exactly.
All you got to do is put water on it, isn't it?
That's it. Well, reconstitute, yeah.
Just put water on it and heat it up.
Huh?
You have to have heat?
Yeah, if you're going to heat it up, you do. Sure.
You can have.
You can reconstitute it. A lot of the stuff is already pre-cooked.
So if the electricity was off,
build a fire.
Sure, cook it with newspapers. Mm-hmm. But,
turn over.
Yeah.
Model gas.
The on weapons, Jack, studying it, I would make the following recommendations. For a handgun, you ought to get a 45. You ought to have at least one shotgun, which would do as a riot shotgun with the barrel cut off to 20 inches. That's legal. Ought to be 12 gauge, and you ought to have double aught buck and number 2 shot. You ought to have one rifle that would be an intermediate range rifle, good to probably up 300.
Like carbine, you mean?
Well, I'll give you 3 of them that I'd recommend.
Double aught and what?
Double aught buck and number 2. Intermediate range rifle, which would be lightweight, easy to carry, a good bush gun. There are 3 of them basically on the market. One is the Ruger Mini 14.
How do you spell it?
R-U-E-G-E-R Mini 14. There is the AR-180. And Cole's got a new Shorty M15 out, which is a very fine gun. All of those 3 guns shoot 223 ammunition, which is very high velocity and accurate ammunition.
What caliber is that?
0.223. It's a little bigger
0.223.
Around. 0.223. Yeah, it's a little bigger around than a
22.
Mm-hmm. Colt M15.
Shorty M15.
Yeah, Shorty M15, relatively new. And I've talked to a guy in California today, said that he shot it. It's a very fine gun. I'd put a 3-fire scope on it. And a swing-away scope. They've got that. You can have the scope up there. You can swing it aside and use your open sights. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'd have one longer-range weapon. Something good to up maybe 500 yards. I'd recommend a 30-06 with probably a 3-9 scope on it. 2 reasons for the 30-06. One, it'll do the job. Number 2, the ammunition is good barter stock, good trading stock. If ammunition gets short, there are a lot of 30-06s around.
No, they've been shooting that for 100 years more or less.
That's right.
With what kind of scope?
3-9. It's 3 power to 9 power. Adjustable scope. Weaver makes it. That's what I'd recommend in the way of armament. At the minimum. You know, I'm sure...
Now, who do you recommend that buys that?
I'm sure that a lot of you... a lot of you guys have heard some of my friends laugh about my preparation. I bet you have, Jack.
No, I think that they're kind of afraid you're right.
Some of them probably think, well, you know, old Gene's twisted off. He's taking a sabbatical and didn't have anything to do, so we just got to think about this stuff, you know. And it may be. You know, I may be totally out of balance on it. But it's not something I've come upon in the last 6 months. I've been working in this direction for 3 years. And I hope I'd be the very first one to hope that I'm absolutely wrong.
What do you got to lose?
Nothing.
Well, Gene,
if you're right,
do you recommend that we buy those guns, Gene?
Yes.
But how many of us do you think will?
I don't have any idea. I'll tell you this, it's a good investment. It'll make you more money than money in the bank. Right. You know, the guns and ammunition have been going up in price an average of 15% a year for the last 5 years.
You got a source on these that you could help us with?
Yes.
Where to buy them and such?
Yes. Guns and ammunition are a good investment. Freeze-dried food's a good investment.
How can you keep people stealing them, though, in your homes and wherever you're going to put them?
Well...
How are you arranging to keep them helping other people that know you got them from going on?
You got them locked cabinets?
Well, yes. Down in Texas, they build a very excellent steel gun cabinet that has locks on it that are almost impossible to pick. And then the best way is seclusion.
Item.
You betcha. Put them where people don't know where they are. I don't mind telling...